Good morning, everyone. Good morning, everyone. Thank you. That's healthy. Two things from last night. I really appreciated what was shared in devotions here. And I think we need to talk about two things. One of them is God's dilemma. There was a certain reason why God in all eternity chose you to be born on your birthday, and you have a mission in the world, every one of you, including myself. And so all of us, you young people, are wondering what that mission is. I was teaching 4 years until I understood that my mission in life was teaching. Some people figure things out earlier than other people. But there's one thing I would like you to understand right up front. Yesterday we were talking about these Dutch Mennonites and how their industry and frugality just make them wealthy. Okay, now listen really carefully. This is God's dilemma. And it's now your turn to face this in your own life. So if God in heaven blesses us with all kinds of blessings, the tendency of fallen man is to look at the blessings, get his eyes on the gift. And when Jesus healed 10 blind men, 9 of them had their eyes on the gift. They were so pleased that they were able to see. The scripture says only one turned around and thanked the giver. Okay, that's true for us. All of us sitting here. We tend to get our eyes on the gift because we're all selfish by nature. We just love the gifts we get and we forget the giver. The people who are going to make it in life, make a contribution in life, and be able to lay their heads on the pillow in death and have a smile on their face are the ones that are going to turn away from the gift and love the giver. And I can tell you, if you do that through life, love the giver. You live in Gelassenheit with the giver. Your life will have meaning, purpose, value, and who knows what else God's going to do with you in the world. And you'll fulfill the reason for your creation. The second thing. I owe this to you. You folks realize you're not Mennonites? This little lady over here, Rui, is half Mennonite, but the rest of you are not Mennonites. You thought you were. Well, that's why we need to talk about things like this. We got called Mennonites because of certain things that happened in history, but we're not Mennonites. Every one of you sitting here, or most of you sit here, not all of you, have a Swiss Brethren background. You have roots in Switzerland and South Germany. And the people who lived in those places were Swiss Brethren. And like I shared with you, maybe I should just refresh this with you. You and I come from down here. What I was talking about last night are the people from up here. And the story of this weekend is the story of these people. Now, how in the world, if these are Mennonites, did we ever get that name? Well, there's two main reasons, I suppose. One of them was, when the Swiss authorities wanted to know what our people believed, in the midst of their persecution of us, we gave them a copy of the Dortre Confession. And the Dortre Confession is a Mennonite confession. In fact, we didn't even agree with everything that's in it, but we just kind of swallowed it and said, okay. And so that made us Mennonite in the eyes of the authorities down here. Because we took a Mennonite position. Now, tomorrow morning we'll talk about that and the implications of that. It's pretty serious, but we'll save that. The other reason for us being called Mennonite, when we got pushed from down here up into the Palatinate, and then in the Palatinate, the suffering we had there, and we were ready to go to America, we came up here to Rotterdam, and the Mennonites paid our bill for passage across. We were too poor to pay our own. And so we became known as Mennonites, for those two reasons at least. Okay, now this morning we're supposed to be talking about the golden era, and I'm going to do a little bit more of a bridge so that you understand. Instead of just jumping from Holland to Russia, we need to do a little bit more of a bridge. Maybe part of the bridge we need to build first is to show you some things on the map. The map back in those days did not look like the map of today. We'll take some lights off here if we could. You notice that that does not look like present-day Europe. All this is Prussia. Says German Empire. It's broken up into bits and pieces. And you'll notice over here, this is, we call North Germany at Holstein. Yesterday we were talking about over here. But look over here. Here's South Prussia. Here is West Prussia. Up here is Danzig. This is the area where all those Mennonites used to live. This is the Vistula Delta. And you'll notice further over here is East Prussia. Okay, this whole area is Prussia. It's the German Empire. Now you'll notice it does not include the Netherlands and the Belgium. Whenever we left, when the Mennonites left Netherlands, they moved over into this area. And I'm oversimplifying it. And please don't these borders changed. And before we go too far there, let me show you some more. Here's another way to look at it. Now this says Germany. This is the German states. Those little things all joined together. You notice Holland and Belgium are separate. This is a disputed area. Down here's Alsace. Some of you people have roots here in Alsace. But over here's where we want to focus. Here is East Prussia. Here is West Prussia. You see this little, I don't know what shape that is. It's just a special little shape up here. It's called the Danzig Free State. It was like a city state. The city of Danzig with the land around it. And this whole thing is called the Danzig Corridor. Now, it doesn't make sense that you have this separated from this, does it? Here's a better part of the map. This is Poland. Here is Germany. Here is East Prussia. And all this Prussia stuff is very close related to Germany. But there's Danzig all by itself. And these Mennonites lived in this area. And some of them actually lived on this side. And we're going to be talking more about that here this morning. Here's even closer up. Here's the Baltic Sea. Here is Danzig. And all those places or where Mennonites lived. The bigger the circle, the more heavily populated that area was. That's the settlements along the Vistula River. And you'll notice the delta up here in the north. This is where they drained all those swamps. And this is even up closer yet. This shows that strange shape of the Danzig Free State. This every place you see a dot is a Mennonite church. And you notice that some of them came over here into East Prussia. And here you can see again all the canals, the river. It empties here, it can go over here, it can go over here, and some of them over here. Just lots and lots of low land. Lots and lots of swamps. Lots of opportunity to drain the land and make polders. Okay, we'll just stop with that for right now. Now, picking up somewhat where I left off last night, these people, these Dutch Mennonites who came from Holland over, proved so valuable to the local wealthy Polish landlords that they were granted special privileges, especially freedom from military duty. But they were too good at what they did. As no-nonsense people, they worked hard, lived simply and frugally, practiced good stewardship, and lived with gelassenheit. Thus, they became wealthy themselves. Now, the former persecuted refugees began to be envied and resented by the local Polish people because of their financial prosperity. A flood in 1676 caused some local people to request the government to expel them from the land. But the government officials had already discovered how valuable they were as an economic asset to the country and refused to expel them. They said, one can easily tell whether a lazy drunken farmer tills the soil or a sober industrious Mennonite. Rather invite more of them than to drive out those already here. So by this time, they're there to stay. In 1740, when my ancestors, and maybe some of yours, were coming to Pennsylvania, Frederick II became king of neighboring Prussia, East Prussia, from those maps. And during his reign, Prussia, Russia, and Austria began to divide Poland between themselves. Prussia claimed the part of Poland where the Mennonites lived. Remember I showed you across the river there were some? Well, Prussia claimed that. Suddenly, the Mennonites got a new government. They didn't do anything. They just woke up one day, they're Danzig Free State. No, they're one day they're Prussian, and the next morning when they wake up, they have a new government. And so they had to have certain loyalties switched overnight, I guess you could say. They never even moved. And so they now became Prussian Mennonites. Religiously, by that time, they had moved from being Anabaptist to institutionalized Mennonite. And by the way, did you know that's true? Let's check you out. Are you Anabaptist? Yeah, you. You're not Anabaptist. Kind of? Not sure? Okay, probably the rest of you feel the same way. That's why we need to talk about things like this to help us understand. Well, do you realize that most of us, we are literal blood descendants of Anabaptists, but there are many Anabaptist concepts we've lost. And so, it's a legitimate question. Okay, well, these people also lost a number of the original Anabaptist concept. And today, we are institutionalized Swiss brethren. We call ourselves Anabaptists, but we're not altogether Anabaptists. Just like these people were institutionalized Mennonites. That'd be fun to talk about what the difference is, but we can't do that right now. When King Frederick came to visit the Mennonite heartland, the Mennonites showered him with gifts from their farms. They presented him with two well-fed oxen ready for the king's table, 400 pounds of butter, and 20 cakes of cheese, together with a large assortment of chickens and ducks. They also presented him with a petition to remain free from military duties, such as the agreement they had with the Polish government. And so Frederick struck a deal with him. If they would pay an annual tax of 5,000 silver coins to support a military academy, they would be exempt from military duty. We must remember that the Mennonites, as well as their neighbors, were subjects of the king, not citizens of a nation such as we enjoy. And that's another major difference. We are all citizens. If we are born in this country, we are citizens, and we govern ourselves. And so in that sense, each of us are equal like this. But when you have a subject king arrangement, it's vertical like this. And that's the relationship that the Mennonites have with the government. They were tolerated by the king to be there. And whatever the king said, you had to do. That's very different from the way we have government today. And so King Frederick tolerated them in his land. And governments need both men and money. The Mennonites were not about to give him their men for his army, but they were willing to give him money. King Frederick and the rulers after him would have liked to have both men and money, but the Mennonites insisted only on money. Governments always need money. In the Mennonites, they found a good source of money. By the middle of the 1700s, the entire group of Mennonites paid a special exemption tax, levied according to their numbers, in payment for the privileges that they enjoyed. And while this is happening, the Mennonites are in the process of acculturating to the local society, even though they lived in strict separation from it. Up until this point, the Mennonites had used the Holland Dutch in their worship services. About 1750, they switched to High German, the official upper status language of Prussia. And so their children were being educated with High German in the Protestant schools they attended. But to do business, the Mennonites had learned to use the local Plattdeutsch, the Low German, what we talked about last night, the common language of their neighbors. And the Dutch language fell into disuse among them. At first, Mennonites educated their own children, especially with their catechisms. Where they had sufficient numbers, they operated their own elementary schools. But the Mennonite schools did not fit into the Prussian scheme. The Prussian, or we could say the public school policies, aimed to create both well-educated and obedient, patriotic subjects. The state made a major push in the 1800s to implement comprehensive, compulsory elementary education as a part of the reform era's efforts to mobilize the masses. Prussian school officials saw religious education in the schools as a key element. The curriculum of the Grandens area elementary schools attended by Mennonites in 1809 taught reading and writing via religion, concentrating on the Ten Commandments, Protestant confessional doctrine, the Lord's Prayer, and the sacraments of baptism and communion. I'll just leave the educational thing. Now we'll look at a word picture of some of their religious customs. The church buildings of the period. Think about this church building now and what I'm going to compare this. The church buildings of the period were constructed of wood, usually with a tile roof with no paint either inside or out. And there was no pulpit. Instead, along one wall, the long side of the auditorium, on a raised platform stood a row of chairs, the middle one of which, slightly elevated above the rest, was reserved for the speaker of the day. The preacher delivered his lengthy sermon seated on the chair, with no books, no notes, no gestures, in the Dutch language. If you ever have a chance to visit one of these Dutch worship services, do it. When I was along with the CLE's crew to Mexico, Pete Peters has his origin among these people. Now, if you know Pete Peters is a very jolly sort of person. But when he stands up to preach among those people, he turns into one of them. And he does it the way they do it. Just monotone talk. He does stand up behind a pulpit. They've accepted pulpits now. But it's just amazing to me. And it would be unthinkable to wear a white shirt in those churches. And see, when he goes away to preach, he always wears a black shirt. And many of those people, they don't feel like they're qualified to preach until they have boots on. High leather boots. And it comes from the passage in Ephesians, feet shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace, which they interpret and understand as boots. And you might see pictures of them sometime. A man, a preacher, walking to church with knee-high boots and a flat-top cap. That is just the way these people dressed. Before the end of the century, however, with the introduction of the pulpit, sermons were delivered standing and from notes or from printed books. Organs were introduced in New Garten in 1788 and in Danzig in 1806, although not without opposition. Others followed later. I'm going to skip over some things. Prussia was awash with the military spirit around 1800 when the French Napoleon Bonaparte threatened to take over Europe. The Prussian nationalistic spirit affected the Mennonites as well. Okay, historically, Anabaptist people, because they were persecuted, become very quiet. Almost a kind of feeling of inferiority. They were tolerated people. And so these Mennonite young people were used to going to church where everything was emotionless. Hours long. And outside church, they could see people dressed in smart uniforms and marching and with a band, and it was all exciting and there was war on the horizon. Why not get involved? What's wrong with us? Dead people. And so many young men decided they're going to join with the Prussian zeitgeist of the times and be a part of resisting Napoleon Bonaparte from coming in and taking over the land. And so some Mennonite young men went off to war for the first time. And some got killed. Okay, so that was bad enough. Remember, they didn't join church till they're in, probably after they're married, almost 30. So what should the church do with returning soldiers? Do you just let them in? Being a tolerated minority, Mennonites suffered another problem. The government would only allow so much land to be occupied by Mennonites. By law, they were restricted from purchasing more land. And the land holdings could only be passed on to other Mennonites. What were they to do with a multitude of sons who needed land for their own new families? Furthermore, if a Mennonite married a non-Mennonite, the offspring could not be Mennonite. No Mennonite converts could be made, period. They were simply a tolerated people, although they were a wealthy and tax-paying people. And so in 1789, the government issued a new edict. Mennonites were not permitted to purchase any more land. Hampered by excessive and unfair taxes, unable to provide new homes for their growing young people, and fearful of the future, the Mennonites now looked about them with heavy hearts for a new asylum where they might be free to exercise their religious convictions without fear of government restraint. Those most vitally concerned at first were the landless, the people at the bottom, and the more conscientious. But where were they to go? While our people were coming to America, they weren't even thinking about America. Do you know what America's reputation was back in those days? It's a place where there were wild people who shot revolvers and drank and ran around. And who would want to go live among people like that? And so that's just no place for Mennonites to go to. So, they didn't even think about going to America. But most providential it must have seemed, just now in the midst of their perplexity, the invitation from Catherine II of Russia was announced in the summer of 1786. She urged them to come to southern Russia where they might enjoy all the privileges, religious and civil, that had been denied them in Russia, in Prussia. And they thought, this is an answer to prayer. And so many of them accepted this invitation. And during the next half century, about half of the whole delta of that Mennonite population moved east to Russia. And I told you that she had gotten this new territory as a result of war with the Turks. And she wanted to put good people in there. Okay, so now I'm going to take us over to Russia. And we'll pick up the story more directly in Russia. See if I can find a picture. First of all, take a look at this. These are the people that were chased out of the land by the government. These are the people that the Mennonites were supposed to replace. It's a little bit, they were a little bit like American Indians. Okay, and I want to show you a picture of the Tsarina herself. It must be over here. Here she is. This is the lady that invited Mennonites to Russia. Catherine II offered generous terms for Mennonites and other German-speaking Europeans to settle in her empire. That's what we're going to go to next now. What were the terms? You'll find this interesting. All right, we'll take some lights back on. Number one, she said, you may have absolute religious freedom. You may practice your religion however you want it. Now compare that where they were in Prussia. That seemed like a dream. Number two, they would get 70 hectares of free land for everyone. Now 70 hectares is approximately 175 acres of free land. Would you take that offer? I'm talking about free. I'm not even talking about a dollar an acre. We're talking about free land. Number three, they were free to engage in business however they want to. Number four, they're free to brew beer and distill brandy. Number five, there's going to be a prohibition against non-Mennonite cafes and inns operating on Mennonite land. In other words, you may have the monopoly on cafes and inns. Number six, there's going to be a prohibition against selling brandy without their permission. Nobody could sell brandy except Mennonites. In other words, this is a monopoly on the liquor business. Number seven, they had 10 years of exemption from taxes. Now remember, they were paying high taxes in Prussia. Now they have no taxes for 10 years. Number eight, the Russian government would pay to get them there. From Prussia down to Russia. And not only would they pay to get them there, they would deliver a supply of lumber for building their houses. Number 10, and they would loan them 500 rubles per family for starting capital. And number 11, exemption from military service. And number 12, they did not have to pay for the maintenance of their roads and bridges and other forms of servitude. It's just like unheard of. This is like a gift dropped out of heaven for them, it seemed. And so, what was their conditions? What did the Mennonites have to do? You can't have everything all free like that, can you? Well, here's what the conditions were, if I can get my... first of all, they had to agree that they're not going to proselytize Orthodox State Church. In other words, you're not going to be evangelistic at all. And number two, anybody who left the Mennonites left the privileges that I just mentioned here. This only applies to Mennonites. Number three, children of mixed marriages would not retain Mennonite privileges. In other words, it's an extension of what they had back in Prussia. You had to be, both parents had to be Mennonite, yes, the children are going to be Mennonite. Number four, the 175-acre farms could not be subdivided by inheritance, but must remain intact. And that was similar to what they had over in Prussia. And number five, the land titles could not be sold without the consent of the village. This is not an individual matter. Okay, so if you were presented with opportunities like that, what would you do? Well, as I said, they just felt like this is a gift from heaven. And so they took her up on this, and they began to move. Now, let me please have some time and space to get myself organized here. This is back in the days before easy transportation. And so it was a major deal to move over there. Let's see. I've got to keep myself organized here. Here we go. Take a look at this. Here's where they came from. This is the Baltic Sea. This is Norway, Sweden. Here's the Vistula River. And they're going over here to the Black Sea. For us, that doesn't look far. But remember, there are no cars, no trucks, no telephones, no airplanes. And you got to move by wagon. This is not the same as going from Philadelphia on the Oregon Trail to the Willamette Valley of Oregon. It's not that far. But it might be as far as going from Philadelphia to, we'll say, Indiana. It's not just down the road. So it is a long distance. Okay? So as we start this part of the story, when the people started moving, they moved first to what we call Cortica. It's the old colony. I think I showed you yesterday. Yeah, right here. The first place they came to was Cortica. Here's the Crimean Peninsula. Here's the Black Sea. Okay. The first two of the following four settlements happened with the encouragement and financial assistance of the Russian government. The immigrants were granted a long list of privileges. I've already given those to you, including the right to operate their own commonwealth within the greater Russian Commonwealth. Okay, I'm going to pause here and tell you how significant this is. Remember last night I told you that Anabaptist people were the people who pioneered the concept of separation of church and state. Pioneered that at great cost of blood. Now, are you getting this? This is very significant. These people were offered the chance to create a state church in South Russia. If they're going to do a commonwealth within Russia, that means they're going to have to operate their own government among themselves. Now, would you do that? Is this a good idea? Let me go on. In reality, they became a state within a state, a kind of state church of their own creation. This arrangement violated the founding principles of the Anabaptist movement, complete separation of church and state. So how could they operate a civil government which included law enforcement with their own church people? Russia, by offering its generous terms of settlement, was not operating on a humanitarian basis. Russia had designs of its own. Russia was seeking to become great and powerful, to become more progressive like the European lands farther west.
The Mennonites from Prussia were experienced, capable farmers who could help modernize Russia. And so, Russia was seeking to rise. The Mennonites were seeking for their own, but at the cost of violating a very basic principle among them. However, in accordance with the social and religious culture of the times, the Mennonites lived and worked in these settlements right here in isolation from their Russian neighbors, to the point of many Mennonites not even being able to speak the Russian language. Their villages did not include native Russians. Furthermore, their German Lutheran and German Catholic co-immigrants lived and operated much the same. Let me pause to tell you that when Catherine invited the Mennonites, she also invited the neighbors of the Mennonites in Germany, the Lutherans and the Catholics. Actually, the Mennonites were only a small portion of the people, the German people who moved to this area. Okay, now when these people came, there were already native Russians in the area. I don't know the story of how the Germans and the Catholics related to those people, but the Mennonites were careful that none of the native people lived in their villages. They worked for them. They were almost like serfs to them. And whenever Russia talked with them later and tried to persuade them not to move, they told them, here in this country you have servants. If you go to the New World, you won't have servants anymore. You have to do your own work. This is very significant, folks, in that the Mennonites were willing to abuse their Russian laborers. They were not willing to pay them. They were not willing to be equal with them. And of course, they were not allowed to have them come into their churches. How many of you read Crossing the Distance, the new recent publication from the CLP? Well, the rest of you have an assignment. That is a brand new book that tells part of the story that I'm giving you here today, but it illustrates what I'm talking about. Knolls Plett had a servant girl. What was her name? Anyuta, I think it was. And he beat her almost to death. And he did apologize for it. He felt bad about it. But Mennonites were not careful to respect these people. And they couldn't really have them in their church. It's like we had upper class Mennonites and we have lower class Russians. That is bound for trouble. However, the Mennonites were only about a tenth of the German people who immigrated to Russia. Eventually, these German islands in Russia came to haunt the Mennonites, even though they were legal Russian citizens. Harry Lowens wrote, quote, "The majority of the Russian Mennonites around 1870 were patriotic and loyal to the Tsar. But they did not identify with the Russian people and did not accommodate themselves to the culture around them. They were little islands of culture of their own." And so Kortytsa was the first settlement. By the end of 1788, when things were tight in Prussia, after Catherine the Great made this offer, and some of them decided to go. Now listen to this. 228 Mennonite families emigrated from Prussia to come down to here. 8 villages of earthen huts sprang up before that winter. And those pioneering families experienced the most difficulties, including the absence of any preachers. Okay, folks, they couldn't bring any preachers. The preachers had money and they needed to stay in Prussia. Can you imagine what this is like, having 228 poor families with no leadership? I just shake my head. The emigrants were in the truest sense abandoned, poor in body and soul. By 1796, 8 years later, when Empress Catherine the Great died, 118 additional families had arrived. By 1824, when the settlement process for Kortytsa ended, There were 400 families that had come, settling in 18 villages. A village was comprised of a central street with a cluster of houses on both sides. It's the same village pattern that can be seen among the Old Colony Mennonites to this day. And by the way, the word Old Colony always refers to this colony right here. It's the Old Colony. It's the first colony. So when you talk about Old Colony Mennonites today, they have roots right here. There's a street down the middle. They just took a piece of land and made a street. And then they put a house, their house barns, and little plots, narrow plots on both sides of the street. You know, the people lived in the part closest to the road, and the back part is where the animals were, just down the street. And a village might have 20 families, 25 families. But there was not enough acreage behind, so they also had fields out beyond someplace that they also went to. So you farmed a little plot where you were with your garden and maybe with your chickens and so on, but you went away from your land right there in town, in the village, to another part where you did your actual farming. Okay, the second village is over here at Moloshna. By the end of 1803, 163 new families had reached Cortiza but did not intend to stay there. This new cluster of immigrants were headed a bit further east to Moloshna. By the end of the next year, there were 342 families strong. This second group stayed at the Cortiza settlement while they built the Moloshna settlement. By this time, emigration from Prussia ended in 1836. 44 villages had been established. The children from the original pioneers planted other villages so that by 1863, the Moloshna colony was strong with 2,000 families and over 8,000 inhabitants. The first people who came had it the roughest. When they got there, by the way, the lumber that the government promised, a bunch of it was stolen until they got there. And they heard that they were coming down to settle these nice lands, but the government told them en route, after they already started, sorry, but the war front is still too close. You're going to have to settle in some other land. And so they ended up settling up here. And they were so upset by this that some of them even refused to unpack. They were hoping that the government would let them the next spring come down here. But they didn't. Eventually, they just did what they needed to do. These people came with leaders and with capital, and these people were already established, and so they could help these people. These are the bravest souls. These people had it much easier in getting started. Around 1840, the Russian government settlement projects came to an end. Further settlement projects would need to be self-supporting. In 1848, Prussia ended the privileges of exemption from military service based upon religious confession. And this religious constriction prompted a new wave of immigrants to Russia. This time, the Mennonites asked the Russian government for permission to emigrate to Russia to a new location. Okay, you'll notice that when they first came from here, they landed down here at Cortiza Moloshna, right in here. Okay, now, they're saying we need some new ones. One of the new ones is up here at Tract, and the other one is at Samara, right up here. Those are the new destinations. You'll notice how far away they are from the original. And so, these two did not have all the benefits that the originals did. The Russian government permitted 100 families to come. And I think that was to the first one. And that was Amtrak. The first 22 families was led by Klaus Epp, who left Prussia in 1853. Folks, that's almost the time the Civil War was starting in our country. But these folks are not poor anymore. Other well-to-do families soon followed, until by 1858, 1,000 Mennonites were settled in 10 villages at Amtrak. And economic prosperity followed right behind. From the colony, Klaus Epp Jr. led a group of emigrants further east to Turkmenistan to await the return of Christ in 1889. That is a separate story. If you have the book, The Great Trek, it's the story of Klaus Epp and what he did. It's a story of tragedy. It's a story of eschatology going wrong. It's a story of gullibility. It's a story of suffering. and a story of people who woke up too late to error. It's all told in this book, The Great Trek. The fourth village, the fourth settlement area, Alt Samara, in 1859, the same Klossap led other families east to the Alexandertal area. By 1870, 100 families had settled in 10 villages in the broad plains of the Samara area. The Alt Samara was the last settlement from Prussia, although individual immigrants, especially from East Prussia, Lithuania, Neumark, Poland, came to the four settlements up through 1880. Interestingly, some Swiss Mennonites of our background, who had earlier moved east to Volhynia, became a part of that larger picture. And so, in these areas now, here as well as the new areas up there, industries that supported agriculture developed. Now get this, in Cortiza, the industrial firm Lepp and Wallman was producing 50,000 grain swathers by the year 1900. That's about the time my grandpa was born. 8 years later, there were 151 industrial firms located in the single town of Cortiza. By this time, the Mennonites were serving all of Russia, providing 6% of all the agricultural equipment for the entire nation of Russia. And so at what price, we could say, did the Mennonites acquire this wealth? When the Mennonites came to Russia, they had no experience in self-government. Previously, they had been tolerated by governments who grudgingly gave them space in return for the tax money they provided. But what should they do when the Russian government told them to govern themselves? They could govern themselves however they wanted to, but they had no experience. Now this is tragic, this is hard to believe, but it's true. The two original scouts that they sent down from Prussia to search out this land were two men by the name of Bartsch and Hoppner. They became the first political leaders, but pretty soon the people deposed them, charged them, and jailed them by the church leadership because they didn't agree with them. What do you do if you disagree with each other and you run your own government? Somebody has to take charge. Somebody has to suffer. Well, the very men who had sacrificed their lives to come down here and search this out became the whipping boys. If this church prospers, who gets the credit? Tell me. Well, it's supposed to be. I'm talking about on a human level.
Leadership.
Okay, if this church has trouble, who gets faulted?
Leadership.
That's right. And so, who is more likely to receive the wrath of everybody if something goes wrong? What's the two guys who went down and searched the land out? And they abused them. No church-state separation existed. In the beginning, it seemed very strange to the individual that one brother should be placed above another brother, but somebody had to charge and collect tax. Somebody had to build and maintain the roads. Somebody had to apply the fire and insurance regulations. Somebody had to provide schools and hospitals. Somebody had to care for the poor. Somebody had to keep order. And somebody needed to punish offenders. Now, if you're your own government, who's going to do that? Own people. How would it feel? How would it feel to you? Brother Steve back there is a friend of mine, so I don't think he'd ever do this. But suppose that you did something that you needed to be disciplined for and he would whip you, physically whip you. How would you feel about him? Would you have a problem respecting him? Say, yeah, you would. Okay. So how is a church supposed to operate like this? This is a problem with the state church arrangement. Well, here's what their plan. The Russian government has stipulated that a Mennonite family could own 175 acres in one farm but could not be subdivided. Thus, each Mennonite farm owner would have one vote. The voters in each village would vote for a mayor and his assistant, as well as a Kalian administrator who would work with Russian officials. Note that the owner needed to be a Mennonite because the Tsar had granted land only to Mennonites. Thus, to own land, one needed to be a member of the Mennonite church. Okay, let's just take Halsey Church, for example. If you folks are going to run your own government, you're going to have religious leaders, but you're going to have also some secular leaders who are going to have to do the secular things, and that's where the breakdown comes. But everybody is elected, and you had to own land to even have a vote. And so what does that encourage? Do you think maybe you might become a church member, or some people might become church members so they have a vote? Well, that's exactly what happened. And it's like problem after problem developed as a result of that. Because God never intended His people to be both a state and a church together. It violated the very principles for which Anabaptism was born. Okay, enter this man. This man's name is Johann Kornes. He was born in Prussia, but he emigrated with his parents to the Wallachia colony in 1804. While the colony, the second colony, was in its earliest days, his father owned the typical 175 acres and acted as the community doctor. But this man, Johann, was early noted for his diligence, his intelligence, and his sense of responsibility. And when he married, he quickly became a successful farmer in his own right. It seemed that whatever he set out to do just prospered. When he was 41, he established an experimental farming station where he raised purebred horses, cattle, and sheep. He imported the best animals from all over Europe, including fine Merino sheep from Spain. By 1847, he owned 500 horses, 8,000 sheep, 200 head of cattle, and cultivated 25,000 acres of land. Now, folks, that's before the days of tractors, long before tractors. He operated a tree nursery from which he sold trees to fellow Mennonites. Remember, when they got there, the native steppes were tree-less. And so trees were a valuable contribution to the land. By the end of his life, he had provided 5 million trees, many of them fruit trees. He also introduced the potato to Russia. He promoted irrigation because the steppes were semi-arid. He encouraged crop rotation. And the Russians who are looking on are impressed. Where does this guy get his smarts? How does he know what to do? When Kornes was only 28 years old, who in here is 28? Raise your hand. Stand up. How old does he look? Does he look old and wise, lots of gray hair? Okay, thank you. Have a seat. When he was 28 years old, the Tsar appointed him chairman of the Agricultural Society with the authority to regulate farming in all the German settlements, Mennonite and non-Mennonite. Wouldn't that be a responsibility? Well, since the Tsar appointed this man to his post and not the church, he had almost unlimited powers. Now, how do you think the church leaders felt about that? He had more power than the church did. The church leaders thought he was promoting economic growth at the expense of church concerns. And some leaders thought he was working too closely with non-Mennonites and the non-Christian Nogai, those people I showed you earlier, similar to Native Americans. When the leaders opposed him, he threatened to have them exiled from the colony. Once again, problems with a state-church combination. Kornes set out to improve not just agricultural issues. He set out to improve Mennonite education as well. By that time, Mennonite education was just the simple rote learning to the tune of the hickory stick, you know, the kind you used to have in this country. But he studied in the latest European educational theories and published rules on how to teach. He introduced new textbooks. He introduced new programs of study, as well as providing trained and licensed teachers. I can't. Thank you. He helped establish a school for girls. Let's see, where do I have that picture? Look at this. Eventually, this is what this school for girls turned into. Quite an imposing edifice. He established a high school and a teacher training school institute, which became the model for other high schools and teacher training institutions. In turn, the developing Mennonite educational system became the model for all of Russia. Mennonite teachers began to teach in non-Mennonite schools. Teachers quickly became influential in colony life. Educated men replaced farmer preachers in the pulpit and other community posts. And by 1900, Mennonite young people began to attend Russian and European universities to prepare for the professions. And Corney's critics did not like all this. The critics saw him as proud, stubborn, and determined to destroy the Mennonite way of life. When he declined other official government positions, he would simply say, quote, "I am nothing but a Mennonite farmer who, at my baptism, promised not to govern or carry arms in accordance with my Christian faith." End of quote. There was a certain humility about him while he had carried all this power. Tsar Alexander I came to visit with him at his house. And Tsar Nicholas I received him as a special guest. And when he died an early death at age 59, many people, Mennonites, now get this next, Jews, Russians, Moluccans, and the Nogai followed his body to the cemetery. And at his grave, they put up a grave marker with the top broken off. A marble shaft with the top broken off, symbolizing his unfinished life. He died at age 59. I'm 63. He died younger than me. Okay, now his life story symbolizes the larger Mennonite story in Russia. Number one, the Mennonites came as a persecuted people from Prussia, but Russia welcomed them, giving them a home. In return, the Mennonites loved the Tsar, singing his praises. And number two, many Mennonites became quite wealthy in Russia, and some of them believed that their prosperity was a sign of a godly life, and that God was blessing their diligence and industry. Their prosperity had no end. For them, life was like one continuous soft summer evening. Number three, many Mennonites develop an attitude of superiority over their non-Mennonite neighbors. They consider the neighboring Lutherans and Catholics a notch lower than themselves, socially, culturally, and religiously. Their non-Mennonite hired hands were definitely inferior to themselves. And number four, to be married or to hold office in a colony, a person needed to be a Mennonite church member. Thus, being a church member often seemed unconnected with being a Christian. As a result, morals sank into the mud. Some Mennonites believe that farming and godliness go together. What was to be done when Mennonites multiplied, doubling in number every 25 years, similar to that the Amish today? You know, that's the Amish are 250,000 strong already, and they double every 22 years in size. That's off the subject. Farms could not be subdivided, and when all available land was purchased, what could be done? Remember, the only landowners had a vote. And so soon, large numbers of Mennonites had no land and thus no votes. Therefore, the colonies had a land-holding class, including ministers, and they had a powerless, landless class on the bottom. Something had to be done. Johann Cornes maintained that a person did not need to be a farmer to be a Christian. He proposed that manufacturing would provide employment for young people. But manufacturing business could not keep pace with a mushrooming population. This man, if he saw a problem, did something about it. He didn't sit there and cry. But even his remedies couldn't keep up with what was being demanded. When the landowning leaders, these are church leaders and civic leaders, refused to deal with the landless problem, the landless people, Mennonites, took their issue straight to the Russian government. At this point, the Russian government allowed subdivisions of the 175-acre farms, allowed their own lands to be sold to landless buyers, and permitted Russian nobles to sell land so that daughter colonies could be created. Now, coming back to this I want you to notice, here's Cortiza, here is a daughter colony at Berkthal, and here is a colony, Furstenland. The old colony people that are in Mexico today come actually from this daughter colony, Furstenland. Okay, these are only some of the daughter colonies. After a while, there were daughter colonies here and there and everywhere. Okay, so in the midst of the terrible moral situation they had gotten into, by the way, drunkenness was one of the big ones. If they operated with brandy and distilling and all that, you understand they had a drunkenness problem. Okay, so what are they going to do? After a while, things get so bad that something has to happen. Well, Klaus Reimer of the Molochna colony provided leadership for the very first renewal movement in 1812, which has come to be known as the Kleine Gemeinde. In 1870, the entire Kleine Gemeinde group moved to North America. And that's an entire story all by itself. We're not going to go there. In 1860, a larger renewal movement, now known as the Mennonite Brethren, formed. The traditional Mennonites did all they could to discredit this new group. Mennonite Brethren teachers lost their positions. Mennonite Brethren businesses were boycotted. Some Mennonite Brethren men were jailed and beaten by other Mennonite villagers. The traditional Mennonites went to the Russian authorities to blackmail them there. But instead, the Russian government recognized them as a legitimate Mennonite group. And that made the original Mennonites mad. The original Mennonites began to persecute the Mennonite brethren. And for years, hard feelings lingered. The feelings were made worse when the Mennonite brethren began to include non-Mennonite background people into their church membership. All the while, the Russian government was noting how these non-resistant Mennonites were not all that non-resistant with their own people. Remember, folks, the government is always watching Christians, how they live, how they relate to one another, how they relate to their communities. Even you folks are being watched. You really are. Nobody's telling you that you're watching you, but you are being watched. At one meeting, officials told the Mennonites, quote, "We have rooms full of files concerning quarrels and fights within your settlements. Why should the Russian government grant them exemption from military service when the Mennonites pled for extension of their long-held non-military privileges?" It was inconsistent, and the government knew it. But spiritual renewal had come to stay. The Mennonite Brethren Renewal Movement not only improved the spiritual quality of their own movement, but eventually improved the quality of spiritual life among the people from which they had separated. I'm almost finished, so if you give me just a few minutes, I'll be on this. I'll be finished with this. That's the secret. The Mennonite Brethren movement was barely off the ground when terrible news came from Tsar Alexander II. The Mennonite privileges granted many years before would come to an end. Why? Russia needed to continue to rise. And to have all these foreign colonies living within Russia was not Russia. We need to get rid of all these little colonies and make everybody Russian. And so they're going to end these privileges. They're not even going to grant military exemption anymore. Russian language needed to be taught in all the schools. It was terrible that after all these years, the Mennonites still did not know the Russian language. The Russian Minister of War exclaimed at one time in one of their meetings, quote, "You have been in Russia 70 years and still cannot speak Russian, and that's a sin." The Mennonites knew of one solution, the solution of their history, move. Move to North America. And when the Russian officials learned that they were about to lose their entire group of exemplary Mennonite farmers, they relented with some concessions. The government would allow the Mennonites to serve a 4-year term of alternate service in forestry work. And when the government relented, only 1/3 of the Russian Mennonites left for North America. 18,000 of them. And those who left were the more conservative ones, the more conscientious of both the Mennonite groups, the old Mennonites and the Mennonite brethren, and the Kleine Gemeinde. The entire group of Hutterites left. And I failed to tell you about that, but if you look right here, right below the Malachna colony, is the Hutterthal. These people had their own story coming, and Johann Cornes took them under his wing and helped them develop a colony. But they did not live in Bruderhof here. But when they moved to America, they moved to southern South Dakota and around Yankton. And there, some of them developed into Bruderhofs, and some of them did not. They continued the way they were right here in Russia. And by the way, their leaders, when they were over exploring in America, had a personal interview with President Grant. That's a story we'll just not talk about right now. In conclusion, though, by 1900, those who remained in Russia, now get this, the people who stayed in Russia in 1900 were chiding those who left. Quote, "See how we are prospering here. You made unnecessary trouble for yourselves by leaving and starting all over in a strange, distant land. We still have our religious freedom after all. We have good education, good music, good books, good farms, good businesses, and an improved religious community. Everything is better now than it used to be." And they were correct. The social, economic, and religious life of the Russian Mennonites was stronger than ever. And before I sit down, I want to show you some overheads of what these Mennonites had accomplished by 1900, the golden era. Look at these. These are Mennonite estates. Fine house. Fine carriages. Fine horses. Many successful Mennonites amassed large estates outside of the Mennonite colonies. This is Jacob Goosen estate around 1900. As Mennonites became more settled and prosperous, they imported design features from Europe, such as the ornate styling of the Johann Peters residence in New Halbstadt. This is a Mennonite brethren preacher and his wife. Fine clothing as well. Okay, we have to stop. I'm overdue 5-6 minutes. I apologize. I'm sorry, I don't want to hold things up. I can collect all this stuff later.